This is Dealing with Mormon Scriptures and the Universe, Astronomy, 1983. In dealing with the Prophet Joseph Smith and his contribution in the astronomical area, you would be surprised at what we have in the Doctrine and Covenants in the prorogate price alone. In that period of time from June 1830 to December 1833, the Prophet Joseph Smith incorporating in the Doctrine and Covenants at least 12 important references that have astronomical importance. And then once again, in 1838, another statement was made. Nearly a dozen references in the Doctrine and Covenants are worth going over. Let me refer to several of those, and then we will try to endeavor, before we get into the prorogate price, something that may have been in the background for the Prophet Joseph Smith. In section 29, it states, "And the end shall come, and the heaven and the earth shall be consumed and pass away, and there shall be a new heaven and a new earth. In fact, they'll melt with a fervent heat," says 101 section of the Doctrine and Covenants. This is a reference that supports many of those of the old prophets concerning the end time and those things that will transpire before Christ comes again. Then in the 84th it says, "And time is no longer." Time is only numbered to men anyway. As far as Christ is concerned and the Father and others on that plane, they see all things from the beginning, past, present, and future. There's a statement here too in the 86th section of the Doctrine and Covenants and 84th, "I will not only shake the earth, but the starry heavens shall tremble." The power that is in the hands of the Creator, that He'll be capable of doing something on a galactic level that will make everything tremble, is most remarkable. In the 88th section of Doctrine and Covenants, says, "And there are many kingdoms, for there is no space in which there is no kingdom, and there is no kingdom in which there is no space, either greater or lesser kingdom. Unto every kingdom is given a law, unto every law there is certain bounds also and conditions. And He hath given a law unto all things by which they move in their times and their seasons, and their courses are fixed, even the courses of the heavens, plural, and the earth, which comprehend the earth and all the planets." And then a statement in the next verse, "And all these are 1 year with God, not with men." We'll come back to a little bit of that when we get into the prorogate price. Section 88 also contains some additional information. "Behold, all these are kingdoms, and any man who hath seen any or the least of these hath seen God moving in His majesty and power." Now, a lot of these verses don't require any comment at this time, but in going over them, there's also one that's most interesting and leads us to our discussion today in the 88th section. "And I give unto you a commandment, that ye shall teach one another the doctrine of the kingdom. Teach ye diligently, and My grace shall attend you, that you may be instructed more perfectly in theory." Now that's a most interesting statement. Students should take that much more to heart. "That if we're diligent, we shall have the grace of God attend us. If we instruct each other, and we're commanded to do so, that the doctrine of the kingdom may be ours, in theory, in principle, and in doctrine, of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth." Now, cosmology has changed from a subject of philosophical and theological introspection into a branch of the physical sciences since the time of Joseph Smith, more particularly. There is now an established framework which delineates the arena of cosmic physics. Almost the entire semantics, vocabulary of these sciences were not available in the days of the Prophet Joseph Smith. That he had anything remarkable to comment upon astrophysical ideas in astronomy is most remarkable. It is not thought that future developments will change the basic picture, but with new development of telescopes we'll be mentioning in the course of these two tapes, you'll find that the picture will vary in a precise manner in terms of its detail as we get more access to the universe around us. Thus, we expect to be able to describe the universe tonight in greater detail, but in the future, with more information, there may be a revision of some things. As a result, observations and advances in theoretical physics will always be sought for. Then now, the development of high-speed supercomputers will enable cosmologists to simulate various aspects of cosmology, to develop models, and then introduce into those models the facts as observed. such as the growth of clustering of galaxies and the evolution of galaxies. At a deeper level, there is now a realistic and exciting prospect of forging a link between the microcosmic world of elementary particles and elementary physics and the theory of gravitation. Anyone who takes literally the verse 78 in the 88th section will be able, of course, to put in basic association those things that are desirable for working out a cosmological interpretation of both the prophet's words in comparison with the Astronomy 1983. This prohibits an individual to put basic assumptions out of sight, where it can never be challenged by direct appeal to observation. Now, theory, of course, begins with hypothesis, speculation. One scientist, Harrison, says, speculation is one of the most exciting and occasionally fruitful aspects of scientific research. It is the recovery and search for knowledge that identifies a scientist. And so when the prophet Joseph Smith in this great section of Doctrine and Covenants received these instructions, teach ye diligently, and my grace shall attend you, that you may be instructed more perfectly in theory, in principle, in doctrine, I find the application to be both theological as well as scientific, in the sense that we're searching for truth. Now, in the 93rd section of Doctrine and Covenants says, and the worlds were made by who? By him. Men were made by him. All things were made by him, and through him and of him. These things are of solemn import. They're deep and require a great deal of ponderous thinking, and we're instructed to read and study, to ponder the scriptures. When we think about those sentences just given in verse 10 of the 93rd section of Doctrine and Covenants, we must therefore perhaps consider the possibility of assuming that the laws of nature are everywhere the same, that things evolve everywhere as in our own neighborhood. This may be a presumption of an underlying homogeneity. But when it says the worlds were made by him, men were made by him, plural, other worlds, all things were made by him, there is an underlying homogeneity there, a similarity. It is possible for an infinite number of isotropic universes to mimic one another at the same instant. As far as our world picture is concerned, we believe that the universe is homogeneous because special location is improbable. And variety in thought and outlook is to be found within a galaxy, and not necessarily by exploring the uttermost depths of the universe. And a finite number of particles can be arranged into a finite number of different configurations. If the particles are rearranged an infinite number of times, then each configuration of finite probability will occur in an infinite number of times. Worlds were made by him, men were made by him. And we learn in the temple that a great deal of what has been doing has heretofore been done. In the 121st section, we learn that all thrones and dominions, principalities and powers shall be revealed and set forth to who? Upon all who have endured valiantly for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Therefore, those with the testimony of Jesus Christ and of the scriptures and of the restoration can be expected to receive in time all that is necessary to understand the dominions and principalities and powers in the universe. And also, if there be bounds set to the heavens, or to the seas of dry land, or to the sun, moon, or stars, and all the days of their days. Space, it seems, cannot terminate at a boundary. Apparently, cosmic plenitude exists because cosmic edges cannot. When we examine each of these paragraphs, there's more to be pondered than I have time. But this brings us through, essentially, a number of references in the Doctrine and Covenants. And yet, in 1830, Joseph Smith had so much, a great deal upon which to build. And we find this in the Book of Moses. And then by 1842, with the publication in the Times and Seasons of the Book of Abraham, in that 12-year period, a great deal of additional knowledge was added to the legacy of this restoration. In the Book of Moses, first chapter says, "And I will show thee the workmanship of mine hands, but not all, for my works are without end." We begin to get a grasp here of a tremendous situation. Moses cast his eyes and beheld the earth, yea, even all of it. And there was not a particle of it which he did not behold, discerning it by the Spirit of God. And behold, he beheld also the inhabitants thereof. And their numbers were great, even numberless as the sand upon the seashore. And then Moses all beheld many lands, and each land was called earth. These are the many worlds that were created, and there were inhabitants on the face thereof. Moses was giving a most unique vision of the creations of God. Still in chapter 1, and the word, by the word of my power have I created them, which is mine only begotten, and worlds without number have I created. And we can ask the sensible question, worlds without number, but how many might this be? And also I created them for mine own purpose, and by the Son I created them, which is mine only begotten. Now Moses, being inquisitive, wanted more information. But he was told, only an account of this earth and the inhabitants thereof give I unto you. For behold, there are many worlds that have passed away. They've gone on before this was created. And there are many that now stand, coexisting with ours, and innumerable are they unto man. But all things are numbered unto me. We want to get an idea of this number. We will find it in another chapter of the book of Moses. Moses said, O tell me concerning this earth, and the inhabitants thereof, then, if that's all I can get, and also the heavens, and then thy servant will be content. And God spake unto Moses, saying, the heavens, they are many. Now the heavens, that could possibly refer to galaxies, are many. They cannot be numbered unto man. If we consider the Milky Way to be our heavens, and the heavens are many. And as one earth shall pass away, and the heavens thereof, even so shall another come, and there is no end to my works. I created the heaven and the earth upon which thou standest, in chapter 2. And then we understand about the creations of the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And in tape 129, I deal with the fourth chapter of Abraham and go into some aspect of this in greater detail. And I, God, set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. Now, cosmology, with the largest telescopes, can photograph billions of galaxies. This observable universe, therefore, contains somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to the 20 stars, and perhaps as many as 10 to the 23rd stars. Now, we'll come back to that number. It's very important. We're just laying a foundation here as we've skipped along. Now we come to the 7th chapter of Moses. These are extracts from the Book of Enoch, given to the Colville Saints as a very interesting bonus. And Enoch said unto the Lord, how is it thou canst weep, seeing thou art holy, and from all eternity to all eternity? And I think in all of the scriptures referring to astronomical parallels or allusions, this next verse is one of the most important. At least I find it so. Perhaps we can examine it, and it'll be the basis upon which the bulk of this discussion will continue. And were it possible that man could number the particles of the earth, yea, millions of earth like this, it would not be a beginning to the number of thy creations. And thy curtains are stretched out still. That requires repetition. Now let's look at this for a few moments. If it were possible man could number the particles of the earth, today, now, they're very close to that. The universe provides us with all of the same set of natural units of measurement. The only objects that appear to be exactly the same everywhere are the atoms and their constituent particles. Joseph knew very little of any of this. A natural unit of mass is the nucleon mass, equal approximately to that of the hydrogen atom. A natural unit of length is the size of the subatomic particle, such as a nucleon. And this unit is known as the Fermi, in honor of Enrico Fermi, and is equal to 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. And a natural unit of time is the period required by light to travel the distance of one Fermi. Now, Richard Tolman suggested that the name Jiffy be used for this unit, which is equal to 10 to the minus 23 seconds. Now, roughly speaking, how much do you weigh? 190 pounds? How tall are you? 5'7", and you then have a normal expectations of life. By referring slightly here to a computer, roughly speaking then, he has a mass of 10 to the 29 nucleons, a height of about 10 to the 15 Fermis, and an expected lifetime of about 10 to the 32nd Jiffies. Now, with such natural units from the subatomic world, we are able to appreciate the lavish scale on which the universe is constructed. Now, let's go back to those numbers. A planet such as the Earth has a mass of 10 to the 52nd nucleons. A star such as the Sun has a mass of 10 to the 57th nucleons. And a galaxy such as our own has a mass of 10 to the 68 nucleons. And were it possible that man could number the particles of the Earth, we now have a number we can use here, 10 to the 52nd nucleons, or particles. Yea, it says in verse 30, if we were to take millions of Earth like this, is that several millions? 5 millions? 10 millions? Let's just say that we take 10 millions, so that we could add 10 to the 6th power to the 10 to the 52nd nucleons. So we'd have 10 to the 58 nucleons that represent particles of Earth, yea, millions of Earth like this. Were it possible that man could number the particles of the Earth, yea, millions of Earth like this, if we're being conservative, we come to 10 to the 58th particles. But it says here, it would not be a beginning to the number of thy creations. And so that's not even a start. What are we going to do? Multiply by 100, a million, a billion times that? Even if we were to do so by another factor of a billion, we'd still only add 10 to the 9th power to that and bring it up to approximately the amount of nucleons in a galaxy of our size, which is 10 to the 68 nucleons. Anyway, let's use that spread. We'll use 10 to the 52nd nucleons for the particles of the Earth, because that's now numbered by man. And a possible 10 to the 58th nucleons for the beginnings of the creations of the Lord. And we might find that a good beginning might reach as high as 10 to the 68 nucleons, equal to the particles in our galaxy. What does this suggest? Let's go over that paragraph again. Oh, were it possible that man could number the particles of the Earth, yea, millions of Earth like this, it would not be a beginning to the number of thy creations, and thy curtains are stretched out still. If we have, then, created worlds inhabited all in excess of 10 to the 52nd nucleons, and probably approaching 10 to the 68 particles or nucleons, then what we want to find out this evening, has astronomy approached the dimensions of the universe indicated in this single verse? Let's then go back and find out. What could Joseph Smith have had available in his time to give him any such criteria, if he was the one who conjured up such a thing? And let's see if we can find out if there's background or basis for some of the thoughts of the prophet Joseph Smith. We want to go back in time. Now, what we're reading from is representative of having been received by Moses 1400 B.C. approximately. And information in the chapters of Abraham would have been even earlier than that, by almost 700 years. That information could have been part of the legacy that was absorbed in Egypt and maintained there. Even Plato, when he wrote his Timaeus and some of the other writings, seemed to have drawn upon knowledge to get some of the ideas that he had. But I'm not sure that Joseph Smith was familiar with much of the writings of some of those great Greeks, because most of it was not available until after the discoveries of much of those documents in 1893. But in the year 611 to 546 B.C., Anaximander, he determined that the sun's distance from the Earth would be 27 times the radius of the Earth. He determined that from a rather interesting procedure dealing with a well and the arc that the sun gave at certain places in Egypt. Aristotle saw a curved shadow on the moon of the Earth, and therefore he knew it was spherical. In 450, Heraclides of Pontus, he was a contemporary of Aristotle, asserted that the Earth rotated. Well, these are some basic ideas found in the Book of Abraham. And in 350 B.C., Aristarchus of Samos, he stated that the Earth is one of the planets orbiting the sun, and that the moon was a little bit more distant. He developed a sun-centered model. 100 years later, Eratosthenes, 250 A.D., he accurately determined the circumference. He was only 5% off. He showed the curved surface of the Earth to be 1/50th of a circle. He determined the Earth's circumference was 42,500 kilometers. It was just in error by 5%. And then Archimedes. Now, that man was the greatest mathematician and scientist before Newton. He dominated most things for almost 1600 to 1800 years. It was almost 300 years later that Ptolemy, in the year 151 AD, He was the great synthesizer. He wrote a masterpiece of complicated geometry, built on the works of Hipparchus and in Alexandrian astronomy. He called it the Almagest. He also included a catalog of 1,500 stars. Very little more was developed for almost 700 years when the Arab school began to modify in Baghdad and Cairo and change some of the problems that the Almagest had created due to the Easter problem. It was a religious modification that was required. Then, of course, we find that for a period of time, from a religious standpoint, there was an Earth-centered cosmology. It dominated for nearly 1,300 years. The Aristotelian logic and so forth had been absorbed and, as a consequence, controlled thinking for a long period of time. However, Parbach and Mueller in Nuremberg wrote up a modification of the Almagest to try to make some corrections. This was 1423 to 1476. And then Copernicus, one of the great giants, in 1473 to 1543, developed the sun as the center and a rotating earth. This was an alternate to the Almagest. He indicated there was a mobile earth, the heliocentric theory. In 1572, everything kind of changed. Supernovas and comets were observed. In fact, one comet was visible even in daylight in 1577. So men began to think. One was Kepler. In 596, after 25 years of search for a harmonic relationship, the size, orbits, and periods of planets, and he had a special problem with Mars, he finally established his laws. This was a final blow to the classical picture of the universe that had dominated for all those centuries. But it took other individuals to modify his particular work. He was supervised by Tycho Brahe. Kepler, after the death of Tycho, was able to get his records, and in 1609 published some information dealing with the empirical and other aspects of his interpretation of the ellipse. He, in fact, established his first two laws. In 1600, Bruno was the one who extended the universe infinitely with no center. Now, Joseph Smith could have got some ideas from him because he also taught the plurality of inhabited worlds. Now, I deplore the situation that a number of historians in our day try to derive some of Joseph Smith's ideas from two or three individuals publishing about the time and just before Joseph Smith in the early part of the last century, where the pluralities of inhabited worlds and the infinite universe with no center and things of this kind seem to dominate thinking. Now, for 200 years, that idea of Bruno's got circulated around, but Joseph Smith did not get his ideas from Bruno. Joseph Smith, in nearly every area where a historian or someone tries to deduce that Joseph borrowed an idea, made a significant alteration or change in that idea and additional significant statements. So Joseph Smith was still in his own prophetic powers. Galileo was around at the same time as Bruno and Kepler. In 1600, when Bruno was establishing some of his ideas, Galileo tried, and he was really the first modern, to experiment, to measure the speed of light. He identified the fact that light was finite. He also started making a telescope. A year later, Tycho Brahe developed his star catalog, only accurate within 1 minute of arc. It raised a lot of doubts because he and others had observed the supernova and comets. They knew they were celestial phenomena. The idea of spheres and the whole aspect of cosmology of his day was being questioned. 8 years later, in 1609, Galileo had a great shock. Can you imagine? With his telescope, he looks into the Milky Way and finds that it can be resolved into individual star images. This was the downfall of the tiered and compact universe. In 1619, Kepler publishes his third law, which is the square of the period of revolution of planets proportioned to the cube of mean distance from the sun. And then, 10 years later, Huygens was developing his pendulum ideas. Galileo was still busy at work, tremendously absorbed with his telescopes in what he was seeing. He knew that the Milky Way, celestial in its tremendous course across the sky, were all individual stars. He proposed his principles in 1632, and of course, you remember some of the history of what happened there. In the last years of his life, he was under the difficulties of the Inquisition. In 1666, Newton began his first tests for the law of universal gravitation. He unitized Kepler's three laws. He was the one who noticed that white light coming through a prism resolved itself into colors, a whole core of colors. He didn't understand quite that what that was, but it was become a very important thing for modern astronomy. In 1687, Newton wrote his principles, united astronomy, correlated Kepler, Galileo, and Huygens. In 1671, Picard had developed a micrometer to go onto telescopes. He developed the first parallel X, 14 million kilometers for the sun. Now they're trying to find how far away everything was. 1675, Romer measured light. He discovered the finite velocity of light using the moons of Jupiter. He came up with a speed of light of 226,000 kilometers per second. It was a little short, but at least he was getting pretty close in his observations of what was happening with the moons around Jupiter. Newton's laws, having been published now, initiated a new period in astronomy. And within a few years, Flamsteed was to become the father of exact astronomy. He measured star positions and had 3,000 of them accurate within 10 seconds of arc. He was the first astronomer royal and developed the Royal Star Catalog. There was also Lacaille and Lelander in Cape Africa. Lacaille had a catalog of 10,000 stars, and Lelander, he cataloged 50,000 stars. And Laplace in Paris began his celestial mechanical studies and ideas. Halley was alive at this time. He measured the proper motion of four stars, Sirius, Aldebaran, Betelgeuse, and Arcturus, so familiar to all young students in school. That was in 1718. 2 years later, he had the lunar position and the synod period. When he died in 1742, the comet was named after him. There was also an important person by the name of Bradley, 1693 to 1762, where he developed the proper motion of stars, aberration, which were confirmed by Romer. He also developed a star catalog of 3,000 stars. These are the most prominent ones you can see when you look up into the heavens if you want to lay out some night and look up and start counting. British astronomer by the name of Wilson in 1774 identified sunspots. And then in 1780, the American Academy of Science was founded. There was a 7-foot telescope in 1774, and with this, Carrier found Uranus. And then he developed an 18-inch and then a 48-inch. He died in 1822. He was in Europe. At that time, there was only a 5-inch telescope in America. Then Herschel came up with the ideas of the solid body for the sun and the luminous envelope, 1795. And Laplace again published his Celestial Mechanics. In 1825, the solar system and laws of gravitation were pretty well incorporated into his ideas. Another thing essential for the development of astronomy was Fraunhofer's recognition of the hundreds of lines and bands, and he assigned letters to these lines and bands on the prismic colors. These letters are used today. That was in 1817. In 1818, Bessel corrected for precision the aberrations, 63,000 stars. Joseph Smith, 2 years later, went into the grove. In 1830, Joseph Smith's revelations, now in the Book of Moses, had advanced cosmological and astronomical ideas attributed to Moses and to Enoch. Joseph Smith could have used, had he had available, any of the works of all of these we just previously talked to. All of them combined would give a few ideas found in the second and third chapter of Abraham, but would not account for what was occurring in the 30th verse of chapter 2 of Moses. So let's go a little bit beyond here. In 1835 and 1837, Joseph Smith translated the Book of Abraham. Astronomy was opened up to him. A tremendous event occurred where he saw the vistas of astronomy, perhaps similar to the ancient prophets and like Abraham. In 1838, the very first American observatory at Hopkins, Wilmingstown, Massachusetts, was established. 2 years later, there was the Cape Telescope operated by Straub, and he was the one who began to get down to within 26 hundredths of an arc in terms of accuracy. And then someone began to try to photograph the moon and some of the stellar objects. In 1839, the daguerreotype was found, and you had your first early photographic discoveries. 3 years later, Joseph Smith publishes the Book of Abraham. Astronomy at that time believed the universe to be older no more than 25,000 years. In December of 1844, after his death, there was a reference to the fact that time had been going on in this system, whatever that means, for 2,555,000,000 years. Then in 1844, the year the prophet was shot to death, the Naval Observatory was dedicated to Harvard with a new 15-inch mirror, or telescope. And then there was a 7.5-inch one 3 years later available. The spectral lines were found by Fizeau, and he even measured some velocities in 1848. And Angstrom published his famous hydrogen lines. All of these were necessary to understand astronomy today. In 1850, there was a photograph made for 100 seconds by Vicqua. He photographed the moon. Then they began to develop in 1850 the wet Collodion photographic principles. And until photography was fully developed, there wasn't a great deal more that could be learned about a lot of things. In 1859, Kirchhoff developed the two basic laws of spectroscopy, and that gas produces bright lines, and the spectrum was developed, and astrophysics was born. Joseph is long dead. In 1860, Rutherford in New York was the first one to photograph the Pleiades, and it wasn't such a bad photograph. A little blurred, but nevertheless real. And 1 year later, LaRue photographed sunspots. In 1864, Maxwell developed the theory of electromagnetism. And in 1865, Forgue considers the sun to be gaseous. And this is the first indication of the possibility that the suns out there, or the stars, are gas bodies. An 18.5-inch Alvin Cook telescope is erected at the University of Chicago. He was one of the great developers of telescopes, his family, in 1866. Then a 12-inch reflector at the Van Vleck Observatory was installed 2 years later in 1868. In 1879, Stefans developed the laws of radiation that increases the fourth power of temperature. And a 26-inch naval telescope was installed, and then this compared with a 25-inch of the Newall in England. Astronomy was starting to come into its own. Michelson in 1880 developed the interferometer. It was a new kind of instrument to be used, and more were to be needed. In 1882, there were 144 operational observatories throughout the world. In 1886, Rowland's tables of wavelength. He was the founder of physics in America. He developed 14,000 solar lines and some other special instruments that were required. In 1888, the 36-inch Lick telescope was put into operation, and in 1887, silver bromide was being used in photography, and things were now being understood to a greater degree. The turn of the century was on its way. 1896, the 40-inch Yerkes telescope at the University of Chicago, and then the great famous work of Hale, the American, took the lead. Quantum mechanics, the information on ultraviolet light moving to the red side, was developed by Planck. And this prevailed until 1928. There was a man by the name of Hartspring. He developed star classifications in 1905, and then Bernard in 1905, the same year, photographed the Milky Way with a 40-inch telescope and noticed the mysterious nebula, particularly in Virgo. Today we know them not as nebula, but as a great number of galaxies, thousands of them in the Virgo cluster. Einstein came out with his theory of relativity in 1906. And Michelson, who won the Nobel Prizes of Physics, was the first American to so do. In 1910, Russell determined some distance so that the distance to the sun, 92.83 million miles, was known. 1912, Slipher at Lowell Observatory noticed the nebula emitted the Doppler-shifted light red effect, to be developed later on in very important in our own modern astronomy. The general theory of relativity came out with Einstein a few years later. And then in 1917, the 100-inch Mount Wilson telescope became operational. Anna J. Cannon, in 1918, classified 225,000 stars in a sequence of decreasing heat, giving them a special sequence. These are now accepted today. It is the greatest single work of stellar spectroscopy ever developed. In 1920, Michelson measured the diameter of the first star, Betelgeuse. And 4 years later, Hubble considered the Pegasus Nebula a possible island galaxy. He was stretching his imagination. In 1926, Michelson finally measured light accurately at 299,796 kilometers per second, 186,202 miles per second. 2 years later, I was born. And that year, Hubble discovered island universes. I wouldn't like to have been born much earlier than that. My love for astronomy is so great. Having been a member of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific since 1949 and had a chance to visit many of the observatories, Mount Wilson, Palomar, Tachikawa, Japan, Hayden in New York, Philadelphia. But Bade and Russell and Goddard and Shapley and Hermason were all now involved, the great American astronomers. I watched with great enjoyment and excitement as they polished and prepared the 200-inch Palomar telescope, which was finally installed in 1948. And then the substance of many things became quite known. 1962, we had the first quasar. 1969, a man on the moon. Who would have expected it in that short period of time since the prophet? In 1980, an X-ray source was found, 23 million degrees centigrade, 400 times the mass of the sun. In 1981, there was a discovery made of the Derides. It was massive, 100 billion times brighter than the sun, 100 times greater in diameter and 10 times hotter. In 1982, another object was found. It was as hot as 500 million degrees centigrade. And by 1983, we had determined, with all of the instruments that we'll be talking about and some other discoveries, that the universe was at least 100 billion light years in diameter, and that it contained about 10 to the 23 stars. Today, 1983, we haven't yet found sufficient stars to give one planet mentioned in verse 30 of the second chapter of Moses a star. We can then state, as far as astronomy is concerned in the future, tremendous discoveries are going to be made. Let's go over some of those and see how they may add to our knowledge and what we might find in additional passages of the Purgate Price, and be able to predict, perhaps, in expectation, what the prophet Joseph Smith may have understood partially in his time. When one looks out towards Andromeda, one of the closest galaxies of similar size of our own, we see the light traveling at the present speed that we know it to travel, leaving that galaxy over 2 million years ago. Being visible without a telescope, even, the great nebula in Andromeda was noticed by the astronomers of antiquity and was recorded in a list of fixed stars, even by the Persian stargazers Al-Sufi in AD 964. The only two other galaxies easily seen with the naked eye, both in the sky, can only be seen from the southern hemisphere. They were first reported in Europe in the 15th century by the Portuguese captains of Prince Henry, returning from their attempts to find a way east around Africa. Because of Magellan's longer voyage a few decades later, the two galaxies have come to be known as the Magellanic Clouds. These clouds, these galaxies, are only part of our local group of more than 31 important galaxies and many small dwarf galaxies. Under the catch-all name of nebula, both distant galaxies and genuine nearby clouds come to the attention of early observers mainly because they were nuisances, very easily to confuse with approaching comets. In fact, one 18th century astronomer, Pierre Machin, in 1784, and Charles Messier, who hunted comets from the tower of the Hotel de Cluny in the Latin Quarter of Paris, cataloged 109 of the most notorious nebula and star clusters merely to remind themselves to ignore them. As a result, many of the majestic galaxies near the Milky Way are identified today by the Messier numbers. They're called M numbers, honoring a man who hated the sight of them. The great galaxy in Andromeda, for instance, was M31. Unable to distinguish between gas clouds and true galaxies, even such men as Emanuel Swedenborg, Thomas Wright, and Manuel Kent in 1750 still nevertheless thought that there were island galaxies. They were guessing. This did not prevent them from proposing that the nebula might be island universes, whole systems of stars so remote that their individual shafts of starlight could not be separated. Now, the phrase was catchy, and the idea quickly gained adherents, among them Sir William Herschel, who compiled the first extensive catalog of nebula containing 2,500 entries. Unfortunately for later students, most of the objects he listed were true nebula. Only a few galaxies had been thrown in. When early spectroscopy started analyzing the nebula in the 1860s, they found that most of them were mere veils of fluorescent gas, and the island universe hypothesis had to be tossed out into the intellectual trash heap. the best scientists had ruled out the possibilities of distant galaxy prematurely. However, some evidence in their favor was beginning. The Earl of Rosse had made out the spiral shape of M15 and had identified 13 other spirals by 1850. The number of other nebula showing traces of spiral structure continued to grow, but Joseph Smith did not have access to Earl Rosse's ideas or what he had been able to determine. Joseph had been dead 6 years. An otherwise unremembered scientist, Cleveland Abbey, published an article in 1867, The Nature of the Nebula, in which he suggested that the Magellanic Clouds and possibly other nebula were really systems of stars similar to the Milky Way, but outside of it. He was ahead of his time. Way so, almost 50 years. In 1864 to 1873, Dreyer and others were working at Cambridge, including Maxwell. Electricity and magnetism was being found. In 1888, when Dreyer published the new general catalog, he listed 8,000 nebula. He gave them the NGC numbers. Over half of these were spiral galaxies. In 1908, when the new index catalog IC numbers had been added, more than 90% of 13,000 known nebula were all unrecognized galaxies. Now they are universally recognized. But not then. One of the first men who had good reason to champion the idea of galaxies was Ritchie in 1908. Using the 60-inch reflector which he had built on Mount Wilson in California, Ritchie was able for the first time to resolve nearby galaxies into individual stars. Unfortunately, the images of the stars were so soft and fuzzy that even he was not sure whether they were stars or tiny remote gas clouds. He was so close. In 1912, Henrietta Leavitt, an assistant at Harvard University, had been set the task of studying 25 Cepheid stars in the small Magellanic Clouds without any idea of the remoteness of the stars she was investigating. But she noticed the characteristic that has since made these variable stars famous. The brighter they are, the more slowly they fluctuate. She thought her find peculiar, published it, and the great Danish astronomer Einar Hertzsprung, co-discoverer with Princeton's Russell of the color brightness graph and of the difference between dwarf and giant stars, realized Miss Leavitt's curious discovery that it might be the key to measuring the universe. Hertzsprung reasoned that the rate of pulsation and apparent brightness might hold good for real brightness as well. And one might be able to find out how far away the star is. In 1913, Hertzsprung at last calculated that any Cepheid with a period of 6.6 days had a real brightness nearly 700 times that of the sun. Cepheids were thus transformed into cosmic beacons that could be used to gauge distances wherever they were visible. The first astronomer to use Hertzsprung's finding as a measuring rod was Shapley, later director of Harvard University. And having repeated Hertzsprung's work and refined it, he went on, in the 2 years, 1916 to 1918, in World War I, to apply the results to Cepheids in the globular clusters of the Milky Way. The discovery of our galaxy was in progress. From his distant measurements of these stars, he was able to map the Milky Way's halo, and then to estimate the size of our own galaxy. The story of the discovery of our own galaxy, let alone island galaxies beyond ours, is tremendous and very interesting. He gave the distance and direction of its hub in the constellation of Sagittarius. Hertzsprung and Shapley then, in effect, had proved that the Milky Way is a single system of stars and that the Magellanic Clouds were remote systems outside the main bulk of it. In 1916, Einstein had published a general relativity theory. Theory of gravitation, which replaced Newtonian concepts with abstractions so difficult that it took a decade even for most mathematicians to grasp them, and one has to be extremely mature today to understand the implications. He suggested that the universe as a whole is positively curved, uncurved, or negatively curved. We haven't decided which even yet. No one can visualize such curved space because man is not four-dimensional, but from a purely logical aspect, it has possibilities. Now, Ritchie, with his 60-inch telescope, had spied a nova in a distant galaxy. Ritchie knew that nova normally reach a peak brightness at least 10,000 times that of the sun, but this one was 8,000 times fainter. Therefore, he was online again for some contributions to distance. In 1917, Curtis received plates from the 36-inch reflector at Lick in San Francisco. He undertook to announce to the world what seemed to him unequivocal evidence that nebula containing faint nova are separate galaxies. But the world of astronomy was not yet ready to accept the huge universe that Curtis had to offer. Will science today accept the huge universe Joseph Smith still states through the writings of Enoch, incorporated into Moses' writings, exists out there? Well, at least a historic wrangle ensued. It was a continuing one for astronomers from 1917 to 1924. For example, a recent observation has shown, published in 1921, that the nebula in the constellation Cetus, number 584 in Dreyer's catalog, is one of very exceptional interest. The nebula is flying away from our region of space with a marvelous velocity of 1,100 miles per second. Today we know of immense galaxies themselves receding from us at 91% the speed of light. He said in 1921, these are the most distant celestial bodies and must be enormously large. He wasn't wrong. We have then the proto-galaxy Californian group. They were against the anti-galaxy Easterners. Well, in true Hollywood fashion, the smooth Easterners were articulate, and the Westerners were only mule stubborn about what they knew to be right. Then abruptly, at a conference session, it's January 1, 1925, the great debate is suddenly ended with a reading of a communication from the California astronomer Edwin Hubble. Hubble himself was absent. He was utilizing the great telescope, and word from him was eagerly awaited, because he was busy taking the first look at the sky with a brand new 100-inch telescope at Mount Wilson. It was then the world's largest. The momentous news he had to report was that the new telescope had resolved into images of individual stars, the three so-called nebula, one being M31 in Andromeda, NGC 6822 and M33. What was more, some of the resolved stars were Cepheids, the marvelous beacons of Miss Leavitt, and they proved to be, by their faintness and periods, that all three nebula were galaxies far, far beyond the island universe containing man. I think this is one of the great stepping stones to understanding of modern astronomy, and yet buried in the writings of the Prophet Joseph Smith was much more pertinent astronomical knowledge of the vastness and greatness of the universe. Eddington pointed out that the theory of the expanding universe is in some respects so preposterous that we naturally hesitate to commit ourselves to it. It contains elements apparently so incredible that I feel almost an indignation that anyone should believe in it except myself. For the reader resolved to eschew theory and admit only definite observational facts, all astronomical books are banned. Now, this is true today, even in science. If we were to ban every book dealing with theory, we'd almost have to ban every book we got. There are no purely observational facts about the heavenly bodies. Astronomical measurements are, without exception, measurements of phenomena occurring in a terrestrial observatory or station. It is only by theory that they are translated into knowledge of a universe outside. What did it say there in the Doctrine and Covenants? To be perfected more perfectly in theory? So while theories of the universe may indeed get gradually closer to the real story, they can never attain it because they would always be missing information. Joseph Smith had the missing information from the man, the God, who created the universe. So did Abraham and Moses and Enoch. In 1976, Benjamin Lee of the Fermi Laboratory could still conclude his speculations about the ultimate theory in saying, "We are living in an exciting era. Let's all get to work." That's what it amounts to. We have no final theories. Very few of the theories have advanced to the status of being a law, which would make them a fact. Now, once the reality of galaxies was finally proved, the study of them shot forward as if it had been building up steam through the previous decades of doubt and debate. Hugh Mason, one of the most technically adept observers in all astronomy, and Hubble proceeded with the 100-inch to scale the ramparts of heaven. How exciting the late 20s and early 30s were. From globular clusters a few thousand light years away, they reached out to the limits of the Cepheid measuring rod, a sphere about 3 million light years in radius. They were able to observe within that 3 million light years radius 20 galaxies. from there, making rough yardsticks out of brilliant blue supergiants in the spiral arms of galaxy, they went on to chart a further sphere containing 200 more galaxies. When they got outside of a sphere approximately 5 million light years in radius, they were outside our local group. For within our local group, approximately 5 million light years in diameter, there are over 31 galaxies. It took them all these years just to see the first 20. Hubble approximated distances by averaging innate brilliance of whole galaxies. Hubble calculated that there were almost as many galaxies outside the Milky Way as there are stars in it. He still didn't even come close to the Enoch numbers. But they were trying. Some galaxies are small, some large, but on an average, each of them contain up to 200 billion stars, and probably a still greater number of planets. His explorations, Hubble, were amplified and confirmed by many other astronomers, Mayall, Kitt Peak, and Shane. And equally important, the knowledge of galaxies was extended to the skies of the southern hemisphere by Harvard Observatory astronomers under the leadership of Shaley and at Bloemfontein in South Africa. Because of these studies, astronomers today know that throughout most of the sky, in any and all directions, where the local river of brightness of the Milky Way runs shallow, galaxies outnumber stars by about 10 to 1. Let's go back then to the 30th verse in Moses 7. If I mentioned earlier that it was 2, it's 7. And were it possible that man could number the particles of the earth, and it is now possible to do so, millions of Earths like this, yea, it would not be a beginning to the number of thy creations, and thy curtains are stretched out still. Now, the observable universe in Harrison's publication is measured in natural units, and we find that it has approximately a mass of 10 to the 80th power particles, the nucleon particle, hydrogen atom, a size of 10 to the 40 Fermis, and an age of 10 to the 40 Jiffies. Now, the age is subject to change as we find bodies beyond in farther space. These cosmic numbers reveal a certain harmony in the scale of the universe, and the more we investigate the cosmic numbers, the more impressive becomes the apparent harmony. But they have nowhere caught up to what Joseph understood, and Enoch, and Abraham, and Moses. Because in stating that if we reduce the entire observable universe to particles of a nucleon size, we have not hardly obtained enough particles for each world indicated to have been created. And yet we've got to be able to find a star for each one of those Earths, those worlds, and heavens for each of them. Therefore, from an astronomical standpoint, we can look forward to tremendous discoveries in the future. Let's look at a few more passages here in the Pearl of Great Price. And Abraham states, "The records have come into my hands." In the Egyptian grammar book, Abraham says that Methuselah was the first to know where Kolob was, which is nearer to where God dwells. He states that he had the records by which he had a knowledge of the beginning of the creation, and also the planets and of the stars. If we could find that beautiful document, we might be able to get some more information from it. He also says that the earth is my footstool. Of all the worlds created in the heavens, this is the one that Christ himself came to walk upon and take upon himself a body. He says, "My name is Jehovah, and I know the end from the beginning. Therefore my hand shall be there." And that's a lot of knowledge to know. You can find some more information on astronomy under the description of facsimile number 2 in the book of Abraham. But that may be mostly Egyptian information. We look to the book of Abraham for Abraham's knowledge. And he says, "I saw the stars, that they were very great, and that one of them was nearest unto the throne of God. And there were many great ones which were near unto it. The great one was Kolob." Now, others have talked on Kolob and other things contained here in the 3rd chapter of Abraham. I want to go back to some other things that are found in the heavens in terms of Kokabim. Kokabim, which signifies stars or all the great lights which were in the firmament of heaven. Kolob is the greatest of all Kokabim that thou hast seen, because it's nearest unto me. We're informed that Kolob governs all of the planets of this order. And we have deduced from the 30th verse of chapter 7 of Moses that there is between 10 to the 52nd and 10 to the 68 or 69 or almost 10 to the 80th power planets, then we need to find out more about our universe and see where we can go from here in modern astronomy. Let's examine some more detail. The most highly organized kind of galaxy is a spiral, and that is what we are, the Milky Way. And then one nearest us is M31 in Andromeda. But how large is our particular galaxy? We'll answer that question as we go along. It usually has three well-defined parts. A spiral has a central hub, a halo of stars, and star clusters surrounding the hub spherically. This is characteristic of our own galaxy. And a disk marked with spiral arms. There's at least three arms in our galaxy. One called Perseus, one Orion, and one Sagittarius. We're in the Orion arm. These were discovered in the last several decades, beginning with some of the work in the 1940s by Dutch astronomers. Hubble himself is aware of trying to identify the families of galaxies because there's huge elliptical galaxies, spiral galaxies, and irregular galaxies. These three families have further identification, of course, and we won't go into that. But the curious anomalies that Hubble noticed had to do with the great galaxy in Andromeda, M31. He could not resolve the hub into individual stars. Bade decided to investigate this puzzle. In the winter of 1941-1942, and the World War had started, when Los Angeles was blacked out, observing conditions were at their best. Bade turned the Mount Wilson 100-inch on M31. Again and again, he tried every photographic trick he knew of to coax individual star images out of the galaxy's central hub. One night in desperation, he abandoned normal blue-sensitive photographic plates, the kind that earlier had revealed stars in this galaxy's spiral arms, and tried some new red-sensitive plates. When he developed them, he found to his astonishment that the entire hub of M31 had been fractured into countless red stars. As I turned the telescope to other regions of this great nebula, he recalled later, moving from the center outward, the pattern of prominent stars changed from red giants between the spiral arms to blue supergiants in the arms. The importance here, the blue supergiants are young stars. The red giants are old. Second generations of stars sometimes occur where you get massive matter of high metallic content, where some stars have gone through a whole cycle and finally exploded and disintegrated in huge nuclear activities, disintegrating through portions of space a large number of heavy metallic elements or larger elements in excess of atomic weight 4. Bade's discovery that the hub stars and spiral arm stars are different had so many implications that it took 10 years and the power of the new 200-inch telescope to work out all the consequences. So much of what we're talking about has been since 1952. In M31, it seemed fainter than other opposite members of the Milky Way. This galaxy was over twice as far away as anyone had imagined when they started examining the distances to some of these places. Bade had effectively doubled the size of the known universe, but it was very small compared to what we learned from Abraham and Joseph. For understanding galaxies, Bade found that the two populations concept was a master key. From Bade's restudy of galactic types in the light of stellar evolution, there arose the idea that the irregular galaxies might represent first stage in massive creations and development of galaxies, huge clouds full of turbulence as they contract gravitationally and begin to condense into stars. Then within a galaxy, there may be centers likewise. Elliptical, spiral, irregulars, and peculiar galaxies, these four types extend outward in all directions. They begin to repeat themselves. Every time an exposure was made at some more distant area and focuses were made, the astronomers found that they pursued galaxies out ever further and further, with more and more powerful instruments to measure their velocities. Now, as far back as 1912, Slippert Lowell had noticed that many of the nebula emitted reddened Doppler-shifted light. Today, this redshift is what is used to evaluate ongoing, outgoing galaxies and also incoming movements. They were forced to the conclusion that remote galaxies and a remote galaxy from the Milky Way, the more remote it was, the more swiftly it is flying away, until the most remote ones now, at a distance of about 32.5 billion light years, are moving at nearly 91% of the speed of light. All sorts of ideas have been tested, of course. One of the interesting things was what was being found in 1933. In the constellation Virgo, there was a prodigious cluster of several thousand galaxies. They were gauged to be about 50 million light years distance and moving away from the Milky Way at 750 miles each second. Then there was another cluster of 300 galaxies found nestled in the bowl of the Big Dipper, looking to be about 650 million light years away, receding at about 10,000 miles per second. And then in the Corona Borealis cluster at a distance of some 940 million light years, there was another cluster of galaxies moving away at 13,000 miles per second. And then a cluster in Bootes, found to be 1.7 billion light years away, was hurtling away outward at 24,000 miles per second. But all of these, even the ones in Hydra, a whole group of faint galaxies, thick as raisins at their distance of 2.7 billion light years, were moving away at 38 million miles distance in every second, one-fifth the speed of light. But these, all of these clusters and several other clusters, were found to be just part of a local group of which our particular cluster of 31 galaxy is on the edge. One of the most exciting documents that I have that came out a few years ago was a three-dimensional photograph that had been made up by Plotz. And then they had taken all of these clusters, thousands of them, and put them in such a way that you could take a stereographic instrument, or if your eyes could adapt to it, and you could see the different clusters and the way they were arranged in three different ways, and the way they plotted them. Other things begin to be found, of course, in our time in the last three or four decades. These particular galaxies in our local cluster are moving quite slow. There are other clusters beyond those. We'll bring them to your attention as we move along here. But galaxies exist in all directions. It seems that connecting gravity with other forces was far from easy. Explaining how they hung in time and in space is most exciting. The theoretical difficulties are well illustrated in the fact that Einstein failed. He spent the last 30 years of his life attempting to unify gravity, electrical forces, and many others. He made no significant progress. I have a photograph of his office the day that he died. And on the board is his unified field theory. Others have not really advanced upon it. Theoretical attempts to understand the universe suffers from the same problem they always have. The universe of 1983 is so small in terms of its observed size that until we get more information, as indicated in the 7th chapter of Moses, the 30th verse, we're still a long ways away from understanding what is going on out there. Now, Joseph Smith said something about worlds without end. All right? We wanted to take up then a couple of thoughts in that regard. They made some studies and find that there are very decided, unique things that must exist in terms of a known universe and other worlds. Life as we know it would become impossible here or anywhere if any one of a considerable number of natural properties were changed. There's at least 10 of these. For existence, protons are 1,080 times as heavy as electrons. This means that the location of the nucleus is the location of the atom, and so chemistry and physics of solids are possible. More equality between electron and proton, and this would not be so. You have 92 chemical elements. 99% of living organisms is made of four of them, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. Why? Because only carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen can readily form multiple bonds and so make the long chains and complex rings that are characteristic and characterize organic compounds. So if you want to make rocks, well, silicon will do. But if you want to make life, it has to be carbon. Now, water, ice floats, but ammonia, ice does not. Only in rivers of water can life survive the winter, a crucial circumstance for evolution. How did the universe find that out? Now, consciousness lies outside the parameters of space and time. Indeed, the work of late Wilder Penfield, he was a famous neurosurgeon of Montreal. He tried to find a physiological locus for the consciousness. He failed. Now, these qualities of consciousness make biologists very uncomfortable. The universe wants to be known. Did the universe come about to play its role to empty benches? Hardly. So astronomers are searching and seeking. But nevertheless, we have the revealed prophet's words concerning the nature and character of who created it and its immensity and what's out there. And all the things out there are numbered to him. Now, quasars are really the probes in terms of knowing the distance of the early universe. Patrick Osmer here recently wrote of a special study where they examined in particularly the southern sky quasars out to a particular distance and did a beautiful three-dimensional programming of what they found. And they were able to identify a tremendous clusters in the heavens of quasars out to approximately a distance of 18 to 20 billion light years. And then a quasar, PKS 2000 number 330, here just recently, was found to have spectral lines toward the red end of the spectrum. This is the quasar with the largest 3.78 number compared with the previous record holder of 3.53. And most of Osmer's work were on 3.53 or less quasars. He places the quasar at a distance of about 12 billion light years. Now, 12 billion light years ago, the light left. If it's traveling at 90% to 91% of the speed of light, it's gone another 10,000 light years since then. That makes it 25,000 light years from us at the moment. This is 12 billion light years, rather. That makes the diameter of the universe based on that quasar approximately 50 billion years. But in 1976, they photographed one with a 4.7. They need a larger telescope to identify it for sure, and it would be at a distance of 32.5 billion at the time light left it. At the speed of light, it's over 50 billion years away from us now. That creates a radius of 50 billion years. Our universe exceeds then a 100 billion year diameter. And of course, you have your rules in terms of the content being increased by that size. What does that mean? That even with all of that, with a nearly 100 billion light year size to the universe, we still only come up with 10 to the 23 total stars in that immense universe. That's still far short of enough stars to provide one star for each of the 10 to the 52 or 10 to the 80 worlds Enoch tells us were created at his time when he understood them, and the process was in progress at all times. So you can begin to get a little idea of the Enoch numbers. That's what I like to call them. And then another intriguing thing was found and published here just recently. Probably the most intriguing cosmological report came from a man called Paul Burt of the University of Manchester using the Newfield Radio Astronomy Laboratory at Jodrell Bank, based on a study of 94 radio galaxies distributed over the sky. He concluded that the universe as a whole is rotating at a rate equivalent to one rotation every 60 trillion years. That's quite a long time. It's the first suggestion that the universe in which we find ourselves, like planets, stars, and galaxies, is rotating. Will this immense universe that is projected with 100 billion years be found to be merely another quadrant, another portion of a much larger space? The Enoch number says absolutely. It has to be. Now, we briefly talked about the Virgo survey that was done. It took 9 years. It produced the first detailed maps of the local supercluster of over 31 galaxies. We just added a new galaxy not so long ago. It was hardly observable because you had to go almost through the dense part of the Milky Way. It's a very large elliptical galaxy called Moffat 1. And we may have many, many hundreds of dwarf galaxies in our particular community. Our galaxy lies at the edge of a much larger assemblage. We call this the local supercluster. Our own galaxy appears to lie almost face on to the supercluster, so anybody in it looking to us would see our beautiful spiral. Our particular galaxy is very luminous. It has, as I mentioned, three different great spiral arms to it. In fact, our galaxy has a dimension to it in excess of 300,000 light years and contains the mass of 2.3 trillion suns. How many Earths are in our galaxy? Probably in the hundreds of billions. One of the most elliptical galaxies, or most largest and luminous galaxy in the entire universe, is in Virgo. It's the elliptical giant M83. And this is just one great cluster. In fact, when you plot that particular cluster, it looks like a flower. So they call it the flower in Virgo. Let's talk a few moments about another area. And that is the instruments we're using and the new age of technology that's coming up. There's at least 22 radiations or wavelengths, 10 types of radiation, and 20 different kinds of detectors that can now be used to evaluate the universe. There's 26 major telescopes in the world today. The largest one is in Russia. We will mention some of the important ones in a few moments, but it's what they're going to build that's quite exciting. We have what we call the new technology telescopes, known genetically and generically as the new technological telescopes, NTTs. These instruments will be radical departures from the optical traditions. There are three independent but closely coordinated projects now underway. At the University of Texas, planning is in progress on an NTT with a primary mirror of 7.6 meters across. The University of California is planning one 10 meters across. And Kitt Peak National Observatory, together with the universities of Arizona, Texas, and California, is evaluating designs for a NTT which will be 15 meters across. Well, remember that the largest right now is about 226 inches, so that a 15-meter across will be nearly 500 inches. It is a light-collecting area twice that of all of the 20 largest telescopes in the world put together. So this combination of telescopes at the University of Arizona, Texas, and California are going to add to our some knowledge of the universe. Now, 13 of the 26 largest currently operational telescopes were dedicated in the last 10 years. And four of these are the first large telescopes in the Southern Hemisphere. One of the first photographs that come out of the Southern Hemisphere showed two great huge clusters of galaxies merging together. Two of the world's four Schmidt cameras with apertures of a meter or more were constructed in that same 10 years. And special image processing techniques borrowed from space technology, some devised solely for ground-based imaging, have served to enhance both the information, content, and beauty of telescopic photographs, and with some of the new computer science have increased 100-fold the precision of these telescopes. So you can see what we're looking forward to in the future. Spectra will be able to be taken 100 times faster than existing instruments. Then there were the space telescopes thrown into space. These, of course, are rather exciting. We mentioned that there was a huge telescope in the Soviet Union. It is 236 inches. I think I might have said 226. The next one is the Palomar Hale telescope. It's only 200 inches. There are 20 telescopes that are larger than 100 inch now. And there are about 8 telescopes that are larger than 150 inch. But as I mentioned, they're going to be building 3 telescopes, one that will be 7.6 meters across, another 10 meters, which will be 360 inches, and one will be 15 meters. So the light-collecting devices will be tremendous. Then they'll be enhanced by modern technology. What will we see? Well, they set up a space telescope called the Einstein in 1978. What it did, in effect, was looked into some of the black holes. Because at a great technological conference that was held a few years ago called the Large Scale Structure of the Universe, what they found was that the universe was made up of a huge net. It looks just like someone had knitted a doily. It states here by Longair, even more surprising are the great holes in the universe. Inastios from the Russian area, his analysis of the velocity of distribution of galaxies suggests a cell structure. And Tiffett's similar analysis argue that galaxies are found in interlocking chains. They plotted a lot of these, and the picture is most interesting. It looks just like a big, huge net. He says, but what is most interesting, and which will have to be accounted for, are the holes. These holes are 30 light years across. Well, they focused the Einstein telescope on a hole. They photographed it with X-ray and other equipment. What did they find? Some additional quasars, additional galaxies, a whole range of other objects in the farther reaches of space. So all we're talking about then is we have a nearby net looking like a fishing net, and out beyond that is an extension of the universe. They call this third-order clustering. So we have then structures. And the largest association of optical galaxies known in the universe are these third-order clustering. Now we're finding perhaps our own immense area of space is rotating about what? What is at the hub of this vast rotation? Well, you can begin to see that I'm excited about astronomy. Why should I not be? Because what is being found out in space? Astronomers go on developing technology and theories. Now, with their computers and everything, they can develop models. These models are abundant. Everyone tries to come out with a new one. They even have a whole group of men working on what they call the grand unified theories. This is serious business. They call it GUTS for short. These theories seek to unify all the forces that govern the structure of matter, microscopic and otherwise. In the last several months, since January, they've announced new microscopic matter. In fact, they're getting down to a point they'll probably reach Joseph Smith's final conclusion that all matter is substance and that it has a spiritual center or substance which may never be seen but can be recognized by the order of energy that is involved. And energy is a great deal. If you were to take 1% of your energy, of the weight of your body, you could generate from 1% of your mass enough electricity to generate power for a city for 1 year, a population of 10 million. So when I look at my little boy crawling around and my grandsons and my others sort of becoming hyperactive once in a while, I just have a little bit of trembling feeling how much energy is really there. No wonder they're that active. And trying to control it is really a thing. The present structure of the universe is really an artifact of the prevailing temperature, low or high, of the universe. And so there's a whole lot of things that are involved. When the clouds that were supposed to become galaxies, and you can go back to the fourth chapter of Abraham now, as mentioned in tape 129, when they were supposed to become galaxies, were condensing out of the primordial medium, Abraham calls it liquid, hydroxyl, hydrogen, it may have had a liquidity to it, all right. The universe was still too hot and was expanding too fast for gravitational forces to be able to pull together enough matter to make a decent-sized galaxy. There are many parameters and limitations that have to be concerned in every theory. Apparently, Abraham understood it pretty well. Somehow, a distribution of pre-galactic clumps that would, at the proper time, under the jurisdiction of God who said they would be obeyed, and they watched, and they were obeyed, then the galaxies condensed, or the distribution of pre-galactic clumps condensed to form galaxies. This has been postulated, follows very nicely the fourth chapter of Abraham. In other words, galaxies exist because they exist. Not quite. They exist because they are the handiwork of intelligent beings. This is what Joseph went on to say. That more than an astronomer observing our universe and trying to find access to great reaches and portions of it, if a man lives this life properly, he can create those immensities out there. The whole delirium of immensity is the handiwork of divine beings. Can we join them? It is stated we can. Now, scientists don't know exactly how it's going to come out, but when they get all the new equipment and everything in the next 10 years in operation, everything we're now talking about will be revised. But will we revise verse 30 of chapter 7? No. We'll still demand that astronomers come up with what really is out there. When they talk about the structure of the universe, when they say that water and other solids can take many interesting crystalline shapes, and then these disappear when solids melt as the temperature is raised, and as the liquid is vaporized, it in turn becomes a gas, and as 10,000 degrees temperature, everything on Earth would be vaporized into a collection of 90 different atoms, but at billions of degrees, these atoms would be broken down into neutrons, nucleons, and protons, electrons, and neutrinos, and at a trillion of degrees, the neutrons and protons would be broken down into quarks or of some other type of matter. Ultimately, according to the knowledge we now know, at 100 octillion degrees, all matter would be broken down into one basic form of matter. Physicists call this particle X. And yet all of this is of a telestial order. What do we find in the Doctrine and Covenants, 76 and 88? We find that this is only one type of universe. It does not mingle or move over into another type, except as we understand that perhaps within this universe, spirit life takes place. There is speeds beyond the speed of light. Moroni came in a shaft of light, the Father and the Son. There's much here to be taken into consideration. It becomes quite exciting then to examine huge, immense ideas, but they still have only been talking about a telestial sphere, telestial order. Celestial kingdoms exist. Kingdoms of darkness where there's no light or radiation of any kind. Our minds need to be expanded to what we find in the scriptures themselves. Our minds have not expanded that far. That's quite plain to see. I've often offered young students $100 if they could find the four salient points in the fourth chapter of Abraham alone. And many of them have tried, but they haven't quite come up with the information that would reward them with that money. But there are four salient parts in the fourth chapter of Abraham. One has to do with what the gods were doing when they went down to matter that was there. Let's talk about a few more things here dealing with the universe. We see that if distances double in size, then con-moving areas increase fourfold, and con-moving volumes increase eightfold. Now, how large of a universe do we have to get approximately 10 to the 80th worlds? You can calculate that out for yourself. It's beyond the comprehension of even astronomers today, and this is still a telestial sphere. Now, the average density of matter in the universe is about one hydrogen atom per cubic meter. In the past, using a scaling factor of 1% of its present value, the density was a million times greater, equal to one hydrogen atom per cubic centimeter. This happens to be the typical value for the density of a galaxy. And from it, we infer that galaxies had not formed when the universe was smaller than 1% of its present size. So we have a lot of ideas here that can be developed and dealt with. In the earlier high-temperature time of the universe, in the fourth chapter of Abraham, the radiation was more dense than matter. The universe was a radiation-dominated universe. And that seems to coincide with what happened when it says, and the gods said to let there be light, and they comprehended that light, a radiation of a type. And out of that, other things were taken and condensed to bring the earth and the things into effect. There is a statement, however, in the fourth chapter of Abraham. It says that the lights, the two lights, were created on the fourth day. That's out of sequence. It probably should be the third day, and you can examine that in light of the temple endowment. If so, and the earth was involved in the first or second day's creation, the earth is much older than the sun. So, as Latter-day Saints, we should expect evidence to come forth to show that whatever they find based on the information of this celestial world and universe, that the sun and the moon are somewhat younger than the earth. And sure enough, Sophia Payne Gaposchkin of Harvard University has published a book. She says, now we have the first evidence that the sun is younger than the earth. There is in the universe, of course, a great deal of young stars. These were the blue stars that Bade found in the arms, and the older stars were the red ones. When they start trying to find other worlds like our own, they have to find approximately a star of the size and shape, mass, luminosity of ours. They'll have to get an Earth about the same size, same type, about the same composition as ours. Life has to respond to a very narrow area, chemical, physical parameters. So as they examine our immediate universe, and there's about 3,000 stars visible to the naked eye, and 50,000 if you got a little nearsightedness, they find that in the first 100 stars near the Earth, two of them are candidates for the possibility of having an Earth around them. Barnard's star even has an opaque body circling it. So we have serious-minded people in Ohio and elsewhere with aimed devices at the universe, hoping to detect a signal from intelligence out there. Joseph Smith is reported to have said that before the Christ comes, we will communicate with the inhabitants of other worlds. That doesn't mean that we're going to have flying saucers and so forth, but it says communicate with inhabitants of other worlds. They'll be like us. The ceremony in the temple tells us quite precisely and plainly that this is a duplicate or a copy of what's been done before. What about those other worlds that passed on? Well, in the seventh chapter of Moses, he states that these were caught up. Thou hast taken Zion to thine own bosom. Before the Christ being the first fruits of the resurrection, individuals on this world awaited the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He is the Savior for all the other worlds. You can get that under the Atonement in Milton or in Bruce McConkie's book on Mormon doctrine if you want to examine it. We have given you some ideas about cosmology as I see it through the eyes of a modern astronomy and as a Latter-day Saint scientist, and a little different approach and pondering of the scriptures as we now have them. It's kind of interesting where it says Eddington is reported to have been outspoken in his delight of cosmic birth and he rejected catastrophic cosmic death. And then we find that he was a bachelor who lived with his sister. Well, it might be that when a cosmologist states a preference for a certain type of universe, perhaps we should not bother to examine too carefully his scientific arguments. We might examine the philosophical and psychological reasons instead. What we're finding, of course, is that God organized and formed the heavens and the earth, a literal statement in chapter 4 of Abraham. And they, the gods, said, let there be light, and they watched and made sure that everything they planned and counseled to do did take place. Then when man goes to the telescope and looks out, he reports such things as this. Here is the report of Bade when he focused the 200-inch telescope in a position that had been indicated by another individual in a letter. He took two photographs of the area of Cygnus, one in blue and one in yellow light. He developed the photographs himself the next afternoon. This is 1951. The telescope had just been barely in use a short time. He says, I knew something was unusual the moment I examined the negative. There were galaxies all over the plate, more than 200 of them, and the brightest was at the center. It showed signs of tidal distortion, gravitational pull between two nuclei. I'd never seen anything like it before. It was so much on my mind that while I was driving home for supper, he said I had to stop the car to think, and he tied up traffic for quite a time. He found two spiral galaxies, flattened Eidan universe, each containing billions of stars, colliding head on end, face to face, like a pair of cymbals. And the Lord says he's going to make the heavens tremble, and shake the stars. We can expect a lot of phenomena when we try to explain just how the Lord created all of these things. So we go to that passage I find most exciting in the 101st section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Verily I say unto you that in that day when the Lord shall come, he shall reveal all things, things which have passed, and hidden things which no man knew. So no matter how much we learn, no matter how much we do, how much searching we are engaged in, what we find instrumentally, with science or otherwise, hidden things which no man knew, and things of the earth by which it was made, and the purposes and end thereof. Yea, regardless of all that we received in these matters heretofore, it says that things most precious, things that are above, things that are beneath, and things that are in the earth, and upon the earth, and in the heaven, will be revealed by the Lord when he comes. What's then the excuse or the justification for engaging in this search if he's going to come and show us all these things? I'm quite sure, and this is a personal belief, that he's probably going to pass a lot of these things on, and if you haven't gained some breadth of understanding, and they're sufficient in the scriptures if you ponder them to be acquainted with what you might expect in the eternity of things. You don't have to be an astronomer. You can gain a popular astronomical knowledge, but you don't necessarily have to be. But if you were such a trained individual, you would understand and probably be very much elated at what you might find and be informed about. So, as a geologist and a mineralogist, an anthropologist, I look forward to the hidden things which no man knew to be revealed concerning the earth, and the power by which it was made, and the purpose and the ends thereof. So as much as I might study these ancient scriptures and these modern scriptures, it's with apprehension that I'm still groping towards something, building a scaffolding, building a foundation, so I can understand when the Lord comes, or if I go there before he comes, what may be all these things. The encouragement to live a greater life, to seek after the Holy Spirit, to lead and guide one in these great things is most exciting. And then this passage, just before the ones I just read. And also that of element, it shall melt with fervent heat, and all things shall become new, that my knowledge and glory may dwell upon all the earth. This is another reference, as we mentioned earlier, in another section of Doctrine and Covenants that parallels that of the great prophets. More detail is found in that marvelous book on the Millennial Messiah by Bruce McConkie, where the prophets foresaw that day when this earth would become new. It will melt with a fervent heat. How's that going to be brought? Natural law, or law that is known to the Lord? This is, after all, a celestial area. Some things could happen, and it will happen. And then this earth will become terrestrial, and that's an entire different type of matter. When we talk about Adam and Eve, We can't biologically talk in any great detail because they had no biological activities familiar with us in terms of the celestial body. There was no death. There was no decay. Everything was quite different. This was of a terrestrial order. When it fell into a celestial state, then whatever is in the earth today that we may think we're dating or think that we're working out, whatever it reflects, and however we chronologically place it, it's all going to be reversed or become that which it was before the fall. So the continuance of this celestial activity and the reality of this present observable universe is of a 6,000-year duration for us on this earth. And then this earth will become entirely different. It'll occupy a new place spatially in the universe. And then at the end of 1,000 years after that, there'll be a new heaven and a new earth, and it'll become celestial. We are not as celestial beings capable with natural eyes to see celestial things. At least that seems to be an indicated situation. So when we look out into space, we're seeing the 92 elements of which we're familiar. 80% of all of the matter in the universe is hydrogen. About a little less than 20% is helium. And then a very, very small percent are the heavy elements of which we find ourselves composed here on this earth. Such a unique thing to have an earth like our own, to have a body like our own. Very unique. Explaining it, the scientists cannot. They don't evade that particular area. They go on observing, and they go on studying and making theories. But in the combination of the Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price, we have the combination of revealed knowledge and scientific knowledge as well. In an ancient text that came out of Russia in 1863, translated into English in 1928, called the Third Book of Enoch, he refers in his day to have known that there were two groups of elements, 70 in the one group and 22 in the other. That makes 92. How did Enoch know that 2,400 years before Christ or earlier? And then he says that the basic thing that composes all of the universe is the first of these 92. It is the building block. So we have some very interesting things for scientists to consider, especially chemists, into how Enoch was able to arrive at that kind of knowledge. Now the theorists, of course, have to consider the fact that initially there was chaos. There was matter unorganized. So I'm going back to Harrison and read you a paragraph. Chaos is dissipated extremely rapidly, they say, by prolific particle creation. If Michael and Christ, Jehovah, initiated an exertion of power such that they dissipated chaos by this prolific particle creation, then they took control of matter that was in chaos. Harrison says, chaos consists of a foam-like welter of space-time, of intense gravitational waves, of field fluctuations, which create particles. Always in the background are virtual particles that, by their readiness to spring into reality, can rob chaos of its frenetic energy. The universe is perhaps homogenized by the creation of a dense sea of energetic real particles. Is this the waters mentioned in the fourth paragraph of, or the fourth chapter of Abraham? The waters above and the waters below? The maximum energy density that space-time can contain corresponds to 10 to the 100 grams per cubic meter, and presumably maximum chaos has this density. So we have the homogeneity riddle. The universe is initially everywhere in a state of maximum chaos, matter unorganized, and the various regions of the universe do not have to interact with each other in order to obtain homogeneity. So the Father's activity and Christ as his chief creator are busy throughout the universe, bringing worlds into existence as Moses was informed, some going on and others coming in, and an ongoing ceaseless universal activity. This ceaseless creation is an ongoing thing. Are we dealing then with our observable space with just a little mini-universe, an unsynchronized region? We don't know whether we're in the center or the edge. You're out on near on the, of a bubble of celestial kingdom or universe. We don't know the extent of dynamic synchronism with our part of the universe with any other part. But the new NTT telescopes and other instruments that they'll be putting in space next year by 1984 will continue the ceaseless effort of man to find out where he's at in the universe and what is happening, to understand the creational activities. Chemists are still trying to understand the absence of stable elements of atomic weight 5 and 8 in the creational activities when you try to take the helium and hydrogen to get a heavy element that composes our bodies. The trouble lies in the fact that the nucleus of mass 5, boron, is unstable. So you have to account then by the nature of secondary activities in the universe or in a galaxy to get the heavier elements. To transform helium into carbon and into heavier elements, to attain this, you have to have then a synthesis through a nuclear activity. And this generally means something along the nova or the breakdown and collapse of a star, the red giants, down into dwarf and into other aspects of the sequence. When they went out to organize matter, they were taking matter that already gone through historical period of preparation. We gain a real interesting insight then into all of these things, and it's most marvelous. I think we've exposed you to Astronomy 1983 and where astronomy is going to be in the future. And I hope that you'll go through the references that I mentioned in the Doctrine and Covenants and in the Very Great Price. And again, remember that nearly all of the Doctrine and Covenants references occurred in the first 3 years of the restoration of the Church. And then the Doctrine, the Purgate Price, half of it, the Book of Moses, was in the first year, from June to December 1830. And then when Joseph Smith got the catacomb records of the papyrus scrolls of Abraham, he worked on them from 1835 to 1842. They're quite incomplete as we have them today. What we have is assembled material, but most of it is there sufficiently for our need. These are scriptures. We're instructed to ponder them. I've merely given you an idea of my pondering. The value of it, of course, is strictly personal. If it encourages you a little bit to probe into the insights of astronomers, into the nature of our universe, into the nature of the revealed universe that Abraham and Moses and Enoch understood, that will be a reward enough. When we go to the fifth chapter of Abraham, with the last comments made there, in closing, we find that the gods concluded upon the seventh time, and remember this seventh time, if it is equivalent to 7,000 years of God's time, 365 days of God's time, and a day of the Lord's time is 1,000 of our years, you will immediately see by computation that that represents 2,555,000,000 years of our time. Question, what does that mean? And because that on the seventh time they would rest from all their works, which they, the gods, had counseled among themselves to form and sanctify it, they found it good, and thus were their decisions at the time that they counseled among themselves to form the heavens and the earth. The heavens involving, as I understand it, the visible stars in the Milky Way. When they were formed in the day that the gods formed the earth and the heavens, and the multiple heavens that's mentioned in Moses refer to other galaxies, perhaps. But Abraham says, now I saw. This was after the Lord's time, which was after the time of Kolob, and Kolob is a governing star, one of 12. We find from reading the Egyptian grammar book that are appointed to govern different spheres of celestial activity, and Kolob is in charge of or governs all of the planets of our order. There's still a great deal to be understood, a great deal more to be pondered upon. And yet, while this is nice to know, it is based on the substance of our own scriptures. There is no way to exhaust the revealed word of the Lord Jesus Christ. And the Holy Spirit then, as you exhaust what is already there, will entitle you to get knowledge beyond that which man has already learned. And if you're privy to such knowledge, how great will your bosom burn. When Joseph had no way of understanding astronomy in his day with the use of Urim and Thummim, the wonders of astronomy were unfolded to him like Abraham of old. Enoch, Methuselah, Abraham, Moses, the great Joseph. They bear witness with their writings that they've had a knowledge of the contents of the universe not yet approached, not even beginning to be approached by the astronomers of 1983. May you get a witness of the great Joseph, the prophet Joseph Smith, and I bear you my solemn testimony. He is a prophet of God. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.